I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 28th of April. Our guest this hour has written, Americans have long valued the potential of schools to provide a route from poverty to prosperity. But such routes are closed if disadvantaged children are directed toward lower-tier tracks and diplomas. History shows that lower tracks are disproportionately occupied by students in poverty and students of color. When lawmakers adopt these misguided policies, they open up opportunity gaps that inevitably lead to the achievement gap that these same lawmakers then decry. Our guest is the author of On the Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation. Carol Corbett Burris is principal of Southside High School in the Rockville Center School District of New York. She was named New York State High School Principal of the Year in 2013. She's also co-author of Detracking for Excellence and Equity and Opening the Common Core, How to Bring All Students to College, also Career Readiness. She blogs for the Answer Sheet in the Washington Post, and she is a vocal opponent of corporate reforms and race to the top. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. We're so modern, at K Dunn Show. Hello, Carol. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me today.
You know, of all the educational issues, I don't think we've looked very carefully at this tracking issue for a long time, and so your contribution to the field is very, very welcome. Can you give us a little bit of the history? Our country's history, you talk about, provides lessons. At the start of the 20th century is when we looked at tracking. For what reason?
Well, what was happening at the time was there were large waves of immigrants who were entering the country. And for the first time, we were really beginning to have public schooling up until the high school level emerging for all kids. Well, folks didn't quite know what to do with kids who culturally were different, who did not necessarily speak English as their first language. And there was a tremendous amount of prejudice. So there were volumes that were written with horrible titles, such as Laggards in Our Schools, and IQ testing was becoming very much the mode. And so what started happening was people began to move away from what had been a classical education for all kids into the idea that what we needed to do was to sort kids by language, sometimes by ethnicity, certainly by IQ, into different life paths that essentially then replicated the social order. Then what happened a little bit later on in the middle of the 20th century was, of course, we began to desegregate our schools. And as we did that, what started to happen was that tracking became a de facto way for some schools to segregate. So that internally, so that what would happen is as the schools became more integrated because of court orders, internally they would resegregate using tracking.
Mm-hmm. Is some of this, you mentioned in a newspaper article that you had written about all this, the president giving praise to the German system of education. From what I know about some European schools, it's very much a tracking situation, isn't it? That your future is decided when you're in eighth grade. You're going one of a couple ways, and one of them and a couple of them aren't college.
Oh, absolutely. And in some cases, it's even prior to the eighth grade. And, you know, it's very easy from afar to say, well, gee, this all looks good. And certainly, there are probably not the issues around ethnicity and race in Germany that there are here in the United States, but there are class issues. And some of the studies that people have been doing is that there are essentially three tracks. One is a college-bound track. Another track leads to vocational, but well-paying jobs in vocation, more technical jobs. And then there's the low track, almost, you know, leading to more menial jobs and poorly paying jobs. And what they found was that, and this is really quite remarkable, is that for those kids in the lower track, that their IQs actually started slipping down, which, I mean, that's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. So that you're seeing growth in that very concept of that we call, for whatever it's worth, of intelligence for kids that are in the higher track, with other kids falling further and further behind. And that's even what we saw in the early research around tracking that happened beginning in around the middle, I would say about the 1960s, really taking a lot of steam and building a lot of steam in the 1980s. The kids that were consigned to the low tracks never caught up. They fell further and further and further behind. So there was one study that actually showed that kids who were dropouts actually had higher achievement than some of the kids that were in low track
classes. Oh, my goodness. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I mean, it's much, much better now than it was back in the day. But, you know, tracking still exists. It still has the same characteristics. And unfortunately, with the really excessive attention now being paid to testing and growth on testing, evaluating teachers by test scores, evaluating schools by test scores, we're actually starting to see a reemergence of tracking even in the early grades, and I find that to be particularly worrisome.
To put all of this in a summary, you write, tracking benefits no one, least of all those students it was intended to help. Detracking, when done systematically over time, not only does not harm the achievement at those at the top of the class, but it benefits everyone. Let's talk about those people who are at the top of the class, because there are probably many of them, not all of them, but many of them have strong parental support. You talk about this, parental and teachers who are opposed to detracking, forming an alignment in some cases. By golly, my kids deserve, they're really smart, they're very, and it's even become worse.
Right.
You know, at 4 years old, I got my college plan for my very, very, very bright child,
right.
And I want my child to have the best, and you can't possibly detract, or those kids who are really smart are going to suffer.
Yeah, and you know, that is the argument, and I would say that if a school does not do it well, those kids could. I don't know that they would suffer, but certainly maybe not reach as much of their potential as they might. However, what we have is, well, we have, for example, one huge meta-analysis done by Ning Rui of the University of Pennsylvania, who actually went through the literature about how kids do in detract settings as opposed to track settings. And he found that, in fact, the preponderance of literature shows that they do not fall further behind. But to use as an example my own school, because that's really
yes.
where my passion comes, we have, for example, all of our students in International Baccalaureate English.
Mm-hmm.
And we have systematically detracted in a very careful way. And the way we did it was not by watering down curriculum or by denying kids access to rigorous instruction. Essentially, what we did was we simply opened it up and provided it for all students and then provided support for the kids who struggle. So if you're in International Baccalaureate English, which all of our kids are, and you're a special education student, for example, or just a student who, you know, English isn't your thing. You tend not to do well in English. We have every other day support classes as well as before school help so that kids experience pre-teaching. They experience post-teaching every other day. They have an opportunity in those small group settings to analyze whatever novel they might be reading or whatever play they might be reading, to get some help with their writing, so that the class itself is not slowed down. We differentiate instruction well, and what I have found is that as our classes became more heterogeneous, our teachers became more ingenious, and they really have found a way to meet the needs of all kids, so that we'll have in our 12th grade classes and our 9th grade and 10th grade classes, you know, the kid who's going to Yale, and we have lots of kids who go to Yale and go to Harvard and Princeton, in the same class with another student who might be going to a community college. And you know what? Everybody benefits. I have an integrated school. 21% of our kids are Black or Latino. 15% receive free or reduced price lunch. And I would say that our most high-achieving kids from the homes of great affluence, you know, have a lot to learn. by having friendships, by listening to discussions with kids who don't have as much as they do and have very different life experiences. So we've really found that everyone has benefited, and you know, our community has, I think because we've done it well, we've done it slowly. Really, I think people are proud of what we've accomplished, and we don't have that pushback that other places have had.
Well, you talk about schools, too, and you just mentioned some of what this means to you, that detracking is a social justice mission that is rooted in the idea that schools need to be socially as well as academically sound. And what you just described is very important.
I think it is. You know, I think it is the way forward for our country. You know, one of the things that concerns me the most about a lot of the reforms that we see now, whether it be the proliferation of charter schools or choice systems or magnet schools for gifted kids, is that essentially what's happening is that we're replicating tracking on this wide scale. And, you know, it's not going to work, and it's not going to help. And while a few kids may benefit, the price that the whole system is going to have to pay, or all of the kids are going to have to pay, is a very steep one. And, you know, I think that as hard as it is, we have to start seriously considering some of the tough issues, like how do we better integrate our schools? And when we integrate them, how do we integrate our classrooms? How do we move away from a system that is more segregated than it was prior to Brown versus the Board of Education,
yes,
you know, 60 years later? You know, how do we begin to integrate our neighborhoods in ways that are smart, that are not going to result in flight of one group or another group? You know, these are all big, tough issues. But unless we're willing to face them and do this kind of work, you can put in all kinds of standards and all kinds of tests, and nothing really is going to get any better. Mm.
You mentioned how voucher and charter schools replicate tracking, and I want to ask more about that in a moment. I'm sure many of our listeners have experienced the tracking system. Would you agree with Carol Corbett Burris, our guest this hour, that it really benefits no one, that it helps the academic achievement, if it is done correctly, of high-achieving students and low-achieving students, to get rid of the whole system? And we'll talk about how that has been done, which tracks are done away with first. Carol Corbett Burris is author of On the Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Struggle Against Resegregation. She is principal of Southside High School in the Rockville Center School District of New York. She was named New York State High School Principal of the Year. She is a blogger on the Washington Post's Answer Sheet, a co-author of Detracking for Excellence and Equity, and Opening the Common Core, How to Bring All Students to College and Career Readiness. What do you think about what she's saying here? That this is just another sign of a bad history here, that separate really is not equal, and the effects of detracking, she says, are equally clear. When all students are given the highest levels of instruction, all will rise to the challenge. How do we make certain that very, very bright kids are receiving the education that they need as well? What do you think? Should we put everybody in the same classroom and then just modify the ways that we teach so that all students can flourish? We would like to hear from you. That's what I'm saying. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also reach us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation. Carol Corbett Burris is our guest on the same track, how schools can join the 21st century struggle against resegregation is our guest. And let's we got a lot of phone calls coming in, so let's go to some. Mart in Sparta is our first caller for you, Carol. Hi, Mart. I'm Matt, rather. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. So I'm just a little confused about what the guest is referring to. She says tracking. What I'm getting from it is, school officials look at the ethnicity of their students and then decide what classes they're going to go in. My experience in school has been your academic achievement decides if you get into an advanced placement class or not. So I'm just a little confused about exactly what tracking is and, what legislation has led to, what track really is.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Oh, sure. Hi, Matt. You're right. I think for the most part, when there is tracking, achievement is part of what assigns the track to the child. There isn't any legislation that I know of that influences this in any way. Schools have a variety of systems. Some systems you have no tracking. Some systems have essentially the kids choose the track. Other systems, the kids are assigned to the track. Some systems have two tracks. Some systems might have five. The issue with tracking that you find, and if you look at the research, and the book talks a lot about it, is no matter what the assignment is in terms of tracks, whether it be by achievement, whether it be by choice, you see the same kind of patterns emerge. The classes are stratified by race and by social class. More affluent parents learn how to work the system and get the high track advantage for their kids, or what they perceive to be the high track advantage. And the kids who are in the lower track fall further and further behind. So that's, the problem then becomes is there another way for it? Is there a way that we can meet the needs of all kids, including our highest achievers, without having all of the downsides of tracking? And my book, as well as the experiences of my school and what we know from research says we can. It's tough, but we can do it.
When you talked about a little while ago voucher and charter schools replicating tracking, what did you mean by that, Carol?
Right. Well, what winds up happening, what we're seeing emerging in terms of charters and in terms of vouchers, is especially in some places, we'll see, for example, and this is happening down south a lot, where a charter school opens up that basically appeals to white students in the district. Or within inner cities where it's a minority population, that charter schools engage, whether by design or just by happenstance, in what's known as creaming, whereby the kids that have the parents who, have the highest aspirations for them or looking for something that's different to apply to the charter schools. They are with other kids that are similar. Kids with special needs are not accommodated by the charter schools, or the strict disciplinary policies eventually cause those kids, who do have some behavior management issues to leave the system. Now, okay, then what happens? Now you have a local public school that tends to have kids that are lower achievers, more kids with special needs, more kids who need ELL services, more kids with behavioral problems. So essentially, a lot of the characteristics that you have from tracking are spilling over into communities. And we're starting to see schools that are very, very different systems. Now, you could argue, well, for those kids that happen to be in that particular school, well, they're receiving some benefit. But then when you look at the whole fabric of schooling, there are other kids that are not receiving benefit and for whom it's detrimental. One of the things that happens in tracking, and we started to see this in some of the research in the 1980s, is that there's a real replication of the social order, and there's also lots of strong peer effects that happen. So, for example, when I started teaching, I was given a class called Language for Travelers. I was a Spanish teacher. Well, in that class for Language for Travelers, which was 26 boys and 2 girls.
Really?
Your passport in was you had to have failed Spanish or French or Italian twice. I mean, this was, without a doubt, a low-track class. And what I saw, you know, the behaviors deteriorated so that all of the role models in the class were kids who were disaffected, and behavior got worse and worse and worse and worse. And then you pull one of the kids out and you say, okay, I'm going to put this kid in, you know, a more heterogeneous class. And all of a sudden, his or her behavior starts to improve. You know, so that kind, those peer effects are very, very powerful, and they happen at the school level. They happen at the classroom level as well, and charters and vouchers tend to exacerbate that within larger systems, within districts and states.
Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Two things. First off, you said, well, they don't have the racial issues in Germany. That would be considered hilarious by any German I know. Germany is full of racial issues right now because of Turkish Germans, East European Germans, and so forth, who are discriminated against and suppressed in ways very similar to the racial problems that we have in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not the Germany of your cliches.
Thank you for that correction. I didn't know it, and my guess is most of those students are in the vocational track.
About Turks especially.
Yeah.
And even if you've been there 3 generations, you're still a Turk to some people. Anyway,
okay.
The other thing is, with no offense to you, and you're obviously a person of great goodwill, I'm in Milwaukee. If there was a public school here that only had 15% of kids on lunches, it would be considered such an elite school. I'm not sure how some of your advice and some of your ideas apply to us here in a school district which the state legislature very deliberately keeps starved and short and on funds, where the majority of our kids are minority in some way. The majority of our kids are eligible for lunches whether they get them or not. I'm not sure if Rockville Center kind of suggestions and ideas are really going to be meaningful for our people.
Well, you know, I hear you, and people have raised that before. And what I would say to you is that even under those circumstances, tracking is not a benefit. My husband was a teacher in a school in Brooklyn, Williamsburg Prep. Very, very similar to exactly what you talked about, 98% free and reduced price lunch. Nearly every student was a student of color, and they didn't have tracking. Well, you know, their outcomes were not as terrific as the outcomes in my high school based on the demographics of the school and the challenges the kids had, but they were a heck of a lot better than schools in the area that tracked. There's a school called the Pro School, which is a charter school in California that is a public charter, and that follows the same philosophy of giving everybody the high-track curriculum and not tracking. It's also a school that is a majority-minority school, also very, very high levels of free and reduced-price lunch. And that's been it's been very successful there as well. In fact, you'll find them on the U.S. News and World Report list of very successful schools. So it may look different in different places, but the idea of not segregating kids from each other based on test scores, based on IQ, based on learning disabilities, works in all schools. So I certainly sympathize with you and wish that you had more resources to serve the kids that you do. And thank you very much for the information about Germany. I don't think, though, that it's an argument against what I said. It's probably even an argument for it. My guess is if we looked at the demographics, we would see some of those groups that you talk about that are discriminated against probably in that low vocational track.
Thank you, Mike, very much for the call. Well, Mike makes an interesting point, because when you look at, and I'm sure other big cities are like this, when you look at the MPS school district, it is heavily minority now. So when we're talking about tracking, it's almost as though we've given up on any kind of goal, which we used to have in this country, to make sure that we are in desegregated schools, that we have to give up that idea when we're talking about tracking, because the schools are 95% minority.
I agree, and I think that that's a great tragedy. And, you know, somehow, I mean, that was when we were talking a little bit before about how we have to start thinking smart about, and hard, it's never easy,
right,
about how we're going to reintegrate schools and decrease the number of schools that are often referred to as apartheid schools at this point, and learn how to reintegrate our communities in smart ways, our schools in smart ways, because the problems are so overwhelming in schools like that, especially when they're under-resourced. You know what? Tracking is almost the least of all of their problems. And that's really a shame. I guess my plea would be in schools that are integrated schools, and if we get to a point where we are beginning to reintegrate our schools again, that we not internally segregate with tracking within.
Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. John is next. Hi, John. In Algoma. Hi.
Fascinating topic and a difficult problem to try to deal with. I had a couple thoughts or a couple questions. I wonder whether your guest would agree that at a macro level, what effect, in effect, we're doing with the privatization and voucher school choices that are being allowed in the state is, in fact, institutionalizing a tracking system, because parents are, the parents who are aware and are advocating for the children very actively are looking for charter schools that give the best possible education for them. The parents who are not engaged with their children's education are simply letting the system choose what school their child would go to, and in effect, at a macro level, we are tracking because of the policies that we currently have in this state vis-a-vis vouchers and charter schools.
I 100% agree. In fact, one of my motivations for writing the book, because it was sort of like, what else is there to say about tracking? There was so much research done for so many years, is that essentially what we are now engaging in is tracking writ large. And in, the final chapter of the book talks about how, you know what, we don't need to figure out how all of this story is going to end with all of the policies you just talked about. We already know it because we know what the effects of tracking are. And all of this is tracking writ large. And we can expect the same outcomes from these policies that we got from tracking when our country was heavily tracked internally within schools.
Could I toss my second question in here? Which relates to resources, actually. My belief, both anecdotally and from what I've read, and as a person who ran a training company, is that education is largely a function of the social environment or social issues and the quality of instruction, and probably least related to the assumed or presumed capacity of the student. And in that context, we're talking about schools where teachers have 28, 30, 32, 35 students in their classroom. To not track and deal with students who are high achieving, average achieving, and people with special needs all in the same environment, I would submit is simply impossible. On the other hand, the social stigma associated with being pulled out of school, pulled out of class for special tutoring or being put into a quote-unquote special class creates a social stigma as well as an association with a social group, which has just the opposite effect it's supposed to have. And somehow we need to get the resources all into that integrated classroom, which means more teacher assistance, so that individualized assistance could be provided to students, which means more financial resources for public education in the classroom.
Well, I think that you would agree with what John says, Carol.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
You know, we will have classes that are 28 kids, 29 kids. We're not going above 30 here. We also, for example, we have full inclusion of special education students, so we're not putting kids into a self-contained classroom that in the past we used to have and that just didn't work. But, you know, then we're having a special education teacher push in every other day or a teaching assistant. So you're right. I mean, All of this is part of doing detracking right. I have in my school building, I have 3 social workers and I have 2 psychologists serving 1,100 kids. They're spending most of their time with our at-risk kids, with our kids with learning disabilities, with our kids that come from low-income households, dealing with social problems. Well, if I have those kinds of resources, what should you have in Milwaukee? You know, we keep pretending that money doesn't matter, right? Because it's very convenient to pretend that it doesn't matter. What's the expression people use? Well, you know, throw money at the problem. Well, stop. Money does matter. You know, to say that poverty doesn't matter, no excuses, is to say that we can ignore poverty. And we can't. I would suggest that you're probably still better off with detracking than with tracking in that environment. But I would also very strongly agree that you need resources, or no matter how you fiddle with tracks, you're probably not going to make much headway in providing kids the education that they justly deserve.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, very much for your informed comments. Our number is 800-486-8655. Carol Corbett Burris is our guest on The Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation is our guest. An email from Aaron. Carol, I was curious as to your guest position on school segregation by age. Would she support the blending of age groups as well, or are we looking exclusively at blending the educational opportunities for this tracking system?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question because I'm not quite sure what the caller or the emailer, I guess, is referring to. I think they might be referring to multi-age classrooms, so that you sort kids based on skills regardless of their age. I don't know much about the research on that. I know people have talked about it. I think that there is a potential danger, which would be what happens when the child then is overage based on their skill level, and now they're in a classroom with a student who is much younger. Now, that may not be what the emailer is referring to at all, but I'm going to make the assumption that he might be. I mean, certainly most of our schools have grade spans that with kids of different ages in it. This is a 9 to 12 high school, and we have some classes that have ninth graders in it as well as 12th graders, depending upon whether it's an elective course. So, you know, without more information, I don't think I can adequately comment.
Tell me a little bit more, Carol, about detracking in your school. When did it start? Did it meet opposition? Are you a rarity in New York schools?
We're a rarity on the planet. There are not too many places that have taken it as far as we have. You know, we actually had, if you kind of go back to the 90s, there was a lot of racial tension in the school to a point where the school actually had to be shut.
Whoops, hello. Oh, we lost you. Shut down is what she was going to say. We'll go back to the history of her school as soon as we get her back on the phone. But now would be an appropriate time to take a little pause. We're talking with Carol Corbett Burris on The Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation. And she is principal of Southside High School in Rockville Center School District of New York, named New York State High School Principal of the Year in 2013. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Carol, we lost the phone line, but Carol was talking about the school being closed down for a while in the 90s, and then the phone went. So, Carol, continue, please.
Right. And I think what the superintendent and the former principal, this was prior to my becoming principal, realized was that a lot of the racial tension was happening in the low track class.
Mm.
So it was a class that was predominantly minority, as well as white students from blue-collar homes that came from a particular part in town. They said, well, you know what, this isn't working. And they very wisely, over time, got rid of that low-track class. And then there were two tracks left, and they allowed parents to choose. Well, then moving forward, what happened was things began to replicate itself so that we had more and more kids who were choosing the high track. So then the new low track began to take on the characteristics of the former track. So we began to think about and imagine what would it be like if we had no tracks at all.
Mm.
And first D-track, the middle school, because we wanted kids to still be able to accelerate in mathematics and take algebra in the eighth grade, what we did was we put all kids in algebra in the eighth grade and gave kids every other day support. It was a huge success. And eventually the middle school was totally detracked. The high school had the two. And then beginning in 1999, I was assistant principal at the time. I recommended that we abandon tracking in ninth grade English and social studies. We did it. It was a great success. And then throughout my principalship, we very carefully and deliberately continued to detrack throughout. A few years ago, took the big leap into the 11th grade. We had completely detracked 9th and 10th grade and said, look, you know, we have IB English for the majority of our kids. Some kids were choosing not to take it. There were not many kids. We said, well, why can't we put all kids in International Baccalaureate English, which is a big deal. I mean, it's a challenging course.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it, and it was great success. And then 2 years later, we said, okay, well, now we're going to move this into the 12th grade. And next year, we're doing the same with IB History. So in a very deliberate and methodical way, providing lots of support for kids, having some elective courses that could really, you know, challenge high achievers if they choose to take those courses, in addition to the regular academics, we have, you know, detract the entire school. So when you walk through the school now, this school is integrated not only in hallways and in phys ed classes, but in all of the academic classes as well. And the achievement of the kids on the top has not suffered, and the achievement of kids that formerly were lower achievers is much higher.
Let's go to more phone calls. Our number, we have a couple lines open if you would like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's go to Laura in Green Bay. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I did teach high school for many years. I'm now retired. And my understanding was that in Wisconsin, tracking is somewhere between highly discouraged and illegal. But what they have is de facto tracking, meaning, again, like Carol had said, you have the three levels. You have, let's say, basic English, college prep English, and then AP English. And, of course, you know, the students are going to choose their own level. They can't be placed in something, but they can choose their own level. But it amounts to the same thing. And I think I think the key is giving them support, because the students, I sat in an empty writing lab for many, many years. Nobody came in to ask for help because there is a stigma about asking for any kind of individual help, at least where I taught near Green Bay. And could you comment on how that was implemented?
Yes.
I'd be happy to. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and you're right. It is still tracking.
Yes.
And it's going to have all those characteristics. So, for example, with our every other day support classes, which I guess would be similar to maybe what you did, is that's part of a kid's schedule. So, you know, they could not go, but they're going to be marked as cutting. And most kids, you know, don't want the detention and everything else that goes along with it. So we do mandate that help. In addition, every morning our teachers provide extra help 4 out of 5 mornings a week. This is, you know, part of their contract, and we reduced class time a little bit to make that happen. And my administrators and I, we walk the halls, and we know which kids are supposed to be in extra help and need it, and we walk them there. You know, we insist that they go and they get it. And you have to do that, and you also have to make sure that there's not de facto tracking from the schedule, so that over the summer, for example, I look at the class rosters. I make sure they're truly balanced, because for me to say to a teacher, we don't have tracking, but then in one class they have all the kids that are taking French and orchestra and, you know, high achievers, and in another class it's all the kids who had the support class, well, that's not fair. So it's a lot of work to make it work, but we do. We don't say to kids, if you'd like extra help, you can go and get it. We tell the kids, hey, you got to get the extra help, and I think that that's key.
Thank you, Laura, very, very much. Unless you had something else, Laura.
No, I think it's really going to help, and but it does come from the culture. They have to value education. And if they do, then everything falls into place.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. Have you found, as you have de-tracked your school and as you look at other systems throughout the United States, does it meet with really very, very high resistance, or is this something that most people would say this is a good thing?
It depends. And it's unfortunate, a lot of it depends on the racial balance in the school. In the book, I talk about six case scenarios altogether of schools that attempted or detracking and made some progress along the way. And there are some clear patterns. One of the schools which chose to remain anonymous, I never quite really understood why, because they had made wonderful progress, was a school in New England, and it was a school that was 99% white. There were some differences in class, but there were no differences in race. And that school, it just did it, and it, you know, and it's moved along, and it's getting better and better. It referred to, for example, the high school where my husband taught. That was a predominantly minority school, almost exclusively minority. That was able to detract without a whole heck of a lot of resistance. But the schools where things got to be very, very tense were schools that were especially close to 50-50 between underrepresented minorities and white Asian majorities. And there you would see all lots of stuff that was really pretty ugly start to percolate up. So that I give an example in the district where I was a teacher, which was highly tracked. I once had a parent who came in and in a very threatening way said to me, you put my daughter, who was white, in the high track. I don't want it with the black kids.
Mm.
So, you know, sometimes people will code it and try to express their feelings in ways that are not as explicit as that parent was. But it does. Race and class and prejudice regarding intelligence, all of those things come into the mix. And so there are several anecdotes in the book where schools made some progress, but then people got scared and they stopped. They didn't unwind. They didn't go back, which is good, but they stopped moving forward. And that really is very tragic.
Here's an email, which is interesting, from Tonya. My child is highly gifted and in a high-performing district. He loves school but is bored in his classes. I personally would love for him to be grouped with other kids who are high-performing so that he can understand that he's not the only one who is smart in his grade. I wondered if you have any experience with the Davidson Institute for Gifted Children, which also promotes what they call grouping.
Well, I'm sure that they do, and many parents believe that their children are gifted and that they deserve to have an education that is segregated from others, that they believe best is tailored to meet their needs. I just don't believe in it. They had very, very bright kids. One kid grew up to be a doctor, and, you know, it's okay. We have kids here that I'm sure are as bright as her child, and they're doing fine. You know, if schools structure it the right way, That being said, you know, there are still other opportunities within schools for acceleration. Every now and then we have a student who has superior gifts in mathematics. Well, okay, well, maybe we let them take mathematics with a class that's the next grade level up. Or we have a science research program that's an elective where kids can meet their talents. I don't think it's healthy for kids, despite, you know, what their gifts and talents might be, to be educated apart from other kids. I think sometimes there are social and emotional prices that go with it. And I also believe that their inclusion within the regular classroom benefits the entire class, that skilled teachers can meet their needs, and that they themselves have something to learn from children who may be different than they. They're going to, at some point, enter the real world. And in that real world, they're going to encounter people from all backgrounds, mm-hmm. who have all kinds of
right.
intelligences. And I just don't believe in that model.
Yeah, the more we're around what makes up America, the better you are, I think, the better served you are in your life.
Well, I think so.
Yeah. Thank you, Laura, very much for your call. And thank you, Tonya, for your email. Jessica in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I taught in Milwaukee Public Schools, and I was a special ed teacher from first through eighth grade, all in one class. And what I found and what I often saw too often was that parents didn't quite know how to choose an effective school for their children. And I shouldn't say an effective school, because what would happen is, for one instance, I had a child with cognitive disability come to my class. And because they were looking for, you know, the numbers for each school and not necessarily if the...
Hello?
I'm still here.
Yeah, you're here.
We lost our caller.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Jessica. You were such a good caller. And you just, do you have a glitter of what she was saying so you can go somewhere with it? Or Carol?
No, I'm not quite sure. You know, I think she's talking about school choice, which I think is more a phenomenon of Wisconsin than it is in New York. At
oh,
least
it's
yet.
Big, big phenomena here.
Ah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know, parents choosing schools would not be part of what our school system does, and the majority of our schools are not choice. New York City, they are, but not in the suburban areas and in most of the small cities and rural communities in the state. We do have a full inclusion model, so that we will have in our classrooms kids who are on the spectrum with autism, as well as kids with learning disabilities and some with emotional disabilities. That being said, the kids with severe cognitive impairments or developmental delays, such as students with Down syndrome, they are not in the regular class. We do have a program, a life skills program for them. They'll not be receiving a high school diploma. But what they need to do is they need to acquire those life skills so that they can live, for example, in an assisted living program after they graduate, or live at home and then have additional supports. So I'm not talking about students with severe cognitive impairments, but rather students who are special education students but are expected to graduate from high school with a diploma.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm sorry, Jessica, we lost the phone call. Well, we're plumb out of time. Carol, thank you so much for being with us. It's the field of education. All this stuff is going on in this field now, isn't it? It's just amazing.
Yeah, you can't even catch your breath.
No.
It's very, very disheartening. My heart goes out to the educators of Wisconsin, because I do believe that a lot of these policies, unfortunately, are on the wrong track.
I know you feel that way. Thank you, Carol, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
K Carol Corbett Burris. Her book is On the Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation. She is principal of Southside High School in the Rockville Center School District of New York and was named New York State High School Principal of the Year. Tomorrow, we're doing, David K. Johnston will be with us the first hour of the program. We haven't talked to him in a long time. So many of our programs over the last year have focused on those who have and those who have not, this growing inequality gap, income gap. And David is really a very fine analyst of what's happening with money in this country and actually throughout the world. He has had assignments all over the world, so he will be with us tomorrow during the first hour of the program. And the second hour of the show, we'll be talking about going green and steps that you can take to make a lighter footprint on this planet. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour and to Marika Suval for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.